let it be known that the president has a very presidential conservative blue suit on and a rep tie with Ohio State colors on.
Please, don't say that.
And I have a green and white outfit on today in your honor. I want you to know that.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
One thing we do know, the cost of higher education is going up. It has never gone down. You just recently went through an increase, and I suppose that's the case around the country, is it not?
Yes, I'm afraid so. It isn't because we want to increase the cost to our students, obviously. We're concerned about the issue of access for all of our citizens. On the other hand, we have to maintain the quality of our institutions, and the fact of the matter is that the states, federal government, simply can't provide us with the kind of resources that they were able to provide in the past. So in order to maintain competitive salaries, in order to support the programs that we have, the quality programs, in order to purchase the equipment we need to provide the scholarships for those students in particular need, we have no other alternative but to increase the cost to our students.
And yet, state-supported schools such as Michigan State are much more reasonable in terms of their costs, their tuition, and their living costs than the other private colleges around the state and around the country. At Hillsdale, for example, or Kalamazoo College or Northwood, the tab for a single year is well over $10,000. At some of the eastern colleges, it's as much as $20,000 for a single year, is it not?
Yes, that's exactly right. And what we've tried to do is we've tried to control room and board costs as much as we've been able to do. And in fact, J.P., freshmen coming to, like your son, to Michigan State this fall, room and board tuition fees will pay approximately $5,200, which, while high, is certainly far lower than it would be at a major private institution, and in fact at some public institutions in the nation. So it's...
$5,200 is a lot of money if you don't have it, if you don't happen to have it. As I didn't when I went to school, and I assume as you didn't when you went to school. But compared to the cost of other major colleges around the country, it is much less, one-third.
Yeah, and I think that there is one other change, and that is that there's a great deal more money available now in student aid than when we were students. I worked my way through college and had no other alternative. Today's students can procure loans and scholarships if indeed they can demonstrate need. And we even increased our institutional or internal aid this year by 30% so that no student will be denied access to our institution because of financial resources, simply because of intellectual capability. And so I think...
If a student is able to learn and shows a willingness to want to go, there is a way to get financial aid.
Absolutely, and not just in loans, but also in direct grants, so that they don't end up so deeply in debt that they can't pursue careers that would be helpful to society.
You know, not so many years ago, your school was called MSC, Michigan State College, and before that, it was called MAC, Michigan Agricultural College. In fact, they were on the big chimney. The big smokestack up on campus, it said MAC up until just recently, did it not?
Well, no, we maintain a smokestack with MAC
it's
and one
still
with
there.
MSC because we want to remember our roots. I mean, we're not embarrassed by that. We're not embarrassed about the rich tradition we have as a land-grant institution.
That's what I'm leading up to. Part of that land-grant institution tradition began with Michigan State. What does that all mean? What is a land-grant school?
Well, land-grants were created in 1862 with the passage of the Morrill Act, signed into law by President Lincoln, as a means of providing opportunity for a broader array of our citizens. Before that time, only those who were affluent attended colleges and universities in this country. Even public institutions in this nation only admitted students who were graduates of private high schools prior to the creation of land-grant institutions. The Michigan Agricultural College, our predecessor, was created in 1855, and it became the prototype, the model for the land-grant movement. The government, in effect, set aside a piece of land in each of our states and granted some money, ergo land-grant, with the understanding that these institutions would provide access and opportunity to all citizens, regardless of socioeconomic status, just predicated on intellectual capability, that they would engage in the development of new knowledge, but would be equally concerned with the application of that knowledge, that is, transfer their technology quickly to assist society.
So it had nothing to do really with agricultural roots, though in fact that's the way Michigan State started.
Well, the Land Grant acts as education primarily in agriculture and the mechanic arts, or agriculture and engineering, because those were the most needed areas at that time. But as times changed, of course, we changed as well. So now we have all the professional disciplines. We have strength in arts and sciences. In fact, the Land Grant Moral Act says that we're not only to provide professional education, but quality general education as well. And then we got much more involved in basic research and in graduate study. So we became far more comprehensive, but always with one purpose, and that was to serve the needs of society.
One of the major institutions of higher learning in the country. There's no question about that. Michigan State is the largest college. Let's get some facts and figures, some stats.
Yeah, 42,000 plus students. And
compared to Michigan, which is...
About 33.
And Wayne State?
Oh, in the 20s.
Okay.
Now, being the largest isn't a particular accomplishment. I'm rather proud of something. You know, the University of Michigan is a great university, great international university, general study, graduate study, research university, and a very important institution to this nation and the world. It's different than we are. We're a great land-grant university with a somewhat different mission. What's really extraordinary is that there's an association, the Association of American Universities, to which only 56 institutions belong, 28 publics and 28 privates. You're invited into membership. You don't apply. Those are considered to be the finest, most prestigious universities in the country, the Harvards and the Yales and the Berkeleys, etc. It's incredible that both Michigan and Michigan State are members of AAU. So in one state, we have two of the 28 publics that belong to AAU.
And that doesn't surprise me to hear that, but I think it might surprise a lot of people. Michigan's reputation, for whatever reason, has overshadowed Michigan State's for a long time, and I'm sure that is of no little concern to Spartan alumni and to you as president.
They shouldn't be concerned about it. They shouldn't be paranoid about it. I have a degree from the University of Michigan. I'm very proud to say that. Great university, but so are we. We have a somewhat different purpose. I think the state's well-served having a great traditional university, elitist in the best sense of the word, and a great land-grant institution. I think we serve the needs of the state and the nation in a unique way.
How did you brought up the difference between the University of Michigan and your school. Let's define that a little more, if you don't mind.
All right, let me
for an undergrad, what would be different between Ann Arbor and East Lansing?
Well, we put more emphasis on undergraduate education. They place more emphasis on graduate education. We, for instance, during this current year in our admissions process, followed a process that we have always conducted, and that is admitting students as their applications came in who were qualified. Now, we have had more merit scholars than any public university in this country. We have produced more Rhodes Scholars than any public university in this country. We're very proud of that. But we're also proud of our commitment to access. So in admitting students as they came in, as the applications came in, we assured that mix from students who were simply qualified to students who were really quite extraordinary. Michigan, on the other hand, held its applications and selected only the highest grade point averages and the highest standardized test scores because it felt that that was its mission, to be very elite and to use as its model some of the extraordinary private institutions in this nation. So that while we both are admitting students that are well qualified, theirs is far more selective in admissions than we are. The outcomes being that slight difference, not very, very major difference in grade point averages and standardized test scores on admission.
You have many more students, too, from within the state, do you not, than Michigan does?
Yes, we have about 90% in-state, and Michigan, as you know, is in the 60s.
And they've been criticized recently for that.
Well, in some ways, unjustly so, because I think their purpose is somewhat different, and there can be a Michigan because there's a Michigan State, just as there can be a Michigan State because there's a Michigan, and I think that's important to point out. Secondly, we place a bit more emphasis in our educational programs on undergraduates. Not that they don't do an excellent job at Michigan as well, but I'm always proud to tell people that 79% of the undergraduate teaching at Michigan State is done by full-time faculty.
Is that unusual?
Very unusual.
To get a school your size?
Yeah, usually it's like 40-50% is done by graduate assistants, not at Michigan State. We're very proud of that. But again, it's a matter of emphasis. Thirdly, as I said earlier, we concern ourselves very much with the application of knowledge. That was part of our heritage from agriculture and engineering. And we worked very, very vigorously on technology transfer. We did that initially, as you know, JP, through extension, where we reached out to farmers and to homemakers, assisting them in resolving their day-to-day problems. Well, now we go beyond that. We work with large and small businesses, large and small communities, individuals, agencies throughout the state.
The extension program is still very much in existence.
Right. But it has a broader purpose. In fact, because of the leadership of John Hanna, who was probably the most extraordinary president to ever serve a land-grant university, we reached out even beyond the environs of the state to the entire world. And so we now have the largest international program of any university, public or private, in the nation, because we see it as our responsibility to work with developing countries, helping them to meet their needs, not only in agriculture, but in education and health and many other areas. Finally, we have a rather substantial service component. It's part of our responsibility to serve the needs of the people of the state. Michigan, while very much dedicated to service and some application of knowledge, sees its responsibility as being the development of fundamental knowledge, and less concerned about dealing with the kinds of problems that we deal with.
Give us some other examples of Michigan State service. Obviously, we here at the radio station avail ourselves of your many services all the time.
Well,
whenever we have a problem or a question that comes up, we call the bug doctor, for example. We get calls about bug.
Sure.
One of your entomologists. We talk to your stargazers in the at the Abrams Planetarium, Bob Victor. It is easy to get information for someone in the business of disseminating information, as we are, from Michigan State. Those kinds of services. What about the private citizens who have maybe very little contact with colleges ever? Can they avail themselves of some of the services that you speak of so proudly?
Absolutely. In fact, it's one of our commitments. Every discipline has to commit itself to assuring that if a citizen requires information on any topic of consequence, that we will find them someone within the institution who can help them. And, for instance, we have a hotline for industry, for business. If they have a problem, they call into that hotline, and then we can make certain that they are brought in contact with the right person. I mean, the individual answering the phone couldn't have all the expertise, but we can get them to the proper person in engineering or one of the science areas or in business or whatever that they might need. And that's very important. I'm glad you asked that question, because citizens would assume that they could not call a university and get information. In Michigan State, we pride ourselves in providing that kind of information. So it would at the time you mentioned a few, there are many, many more. I just don't want us to lose sight of that responsibility. You know, the tendency, and you can appreciate why, would be to try to be competitive by being like other institutions, by becoming more traditional, more elitist. I don't think we should do that. I think we should maintain our commitment to our fundamental purpose and mission. And we're trying to do that. In fact, when I arrived, I was a little concerned that we might be moving a little bit in the other direction. I think we're back on track now. And I think you'll even hear more about those kinds of activities from us. I've met with every...
More service activities?
Sure. I've met with every CEO of every corporation in this state now. My message to them is always the same. Our destiny, our prosperity, our success is interdependent. We must work closely together. That is education, business, and government, because we're all going to succeed or we're all going to fail together. And I really believe that message. But I've said the same thing to community leaders, service clubs, whomever I've been had the opportunity to speak with, because I think that's true. We can't isolate ourselves.
My special guest is the president of Michigan State University, Dr. John A. D. Biagio. We're talking about his favorite subject these days, Michigan State University. How many schools, how many colleges in the undergrad?
Well, it depends how you count them. We have about 14 colleges, but there are other programs, so it's really... We cover the whole spectrum, JP. I think the only thing that we don't have is a law school at Michigan State. Every other discipline is covered. And, in fact, as you know, we have two medical schools, plus a veterinary school. Interesting, the medical schools are interesting in themselves.
The medical school really is the... Wasn't that the first medical school which combined MD studies and DO studies?
We have both programs, both MD and DO, separate, but... working together.
Are they separate?
Yeah.
Totally separate?
Separate colleges. They use
they
some
don't
of the
attend
same,
the classes some, in common?
Some basic science courses, but a great deal of it separate. What I like is that they're really land-grant medical schools. I mean, you've heard debate about whether we have too many medical colleges producing too many medical graduates. I'm not sure that that's true. But in the case of Michigan State, it is the only institution that's dedicated to producing generalists. Yeah, across the board, whether they be internal medicine or pediatrics or OBGYN, whatever, or family physicians. And the way we accomplish that is by not having a university hospital. Our students work in community hospitals throughout the state so that they get a real feeling for the needs of the community. And wherever we're located, be it in the UP or wherever, we're very much appreciated for that reason. Our medical students don't even look traditional. We have a large minority component, many women, older students in medical school, with a special kind of a commitment to serving people in a general sense, not being a specialist, particularly very sophisticated specialist.
Really?
Yes.
Do you turn out more family practice physicians than, for example, U of M?
Yes.
Or Wayne State?
Yeah, and you know, again, Michigan, the University of Michigan's medical center is one of the finest tertiary care centers in the world. And that's where they dedicate their attention. We dedicate our attention to the production of generalists.
Would there be a Michigan State Law School in the future? Is there a need?
Well, you know, there could have been at one time. The legislature pressed for one. The university declined, because it had many other, demands at that particular moment in its history. I think that's unfortunate. I would have liked to, but I'd still like to see them have a law school eventually dedicated again to sort of the land-grant mission, producing lawyers who would see as their fundamental purpose serving the needs of people, the ordinary citizen, rather than becoming corporate attorneys. Very important. And, of course, there's a great deal more money in that, but we need to have people good, you know, functional attorneys to serve the needs of the everyday citizen.
How big can you get before you become unwieldy?
We're not going to get any bigger. We once were bigger, as you know. We once got up as high as 46,000. We made the decision then that we would freeze our enrollment. There's a limit, JP, I think, to what you can do and be effective. I worry about getting too large where you lose contact with the individual student.
Well, that's, you know, that's a complaint, I'm not sure, valid one, that you hear frequently, particularly from high school students, seniors, who are trying to decide what they're going to do with their lives, and they're talking about large universities like yours versus small colleges, and the one thing that they bring up constantly, because they've heard it from all their peers and perhaps from their teachers in high school, is that if you go to a state school as large as a Michigan State or a Michigan, that you're just going to be a number, that you will get lost, that you'll be far better served at a smaller college. I've never been sure that that was a valid criticism at all, but what do you think? You've gone to big ones and small ones.
I've talked to our students, and I've attended both kinds of institutions. That's not the case at all. Because they usually identify with their own college, with their own dormitory, with their own fraternity, the club that they belong to. Plus the fact that at least for Michigan State, and I can only speak for Michigan State, that we do care about the individual student. There's a lots of attention given to the individual student. And I have asked many of our students, and I know them well. I eat in the residence halls with the students, and I really do know our students. Now, they tell me that they don't have that feeling at all, that it's a great big place that doesn't feel big. And I believe that to be the case. Again, it goes back to this commitment to the undergraduate student, a real concern on the part of the faculty, the staff, for the individual student. Wonderful story, JP. I think it's reflective of our faculty. We have an astronomer on our campus who just made a rather amazing discovery in an entirely new galaxy. She was quoted national press across the country. Photographs of her discovery were on the cover of Science, really important in matter. She was, of course, a public figure immediately. And the press, the media, wanted to interview her, which gave her an opportunity for a great deal of notoriety. Certainly a lot of self-aggrandizement, as you might guess.
That's okay.
She told them that they would have to wait a day because she was scheduled to teach a beginning first year astronomy class that day, and she wasn't going to miss her class.
Dedication.
Yeah.
I hope all your instructors are that way.
I like to think that they are, and I like to think that the university is that way. I hope that I reflect that, because I really do care for our students. I just might mention parenthetically that I'm getting a little tired, weary, of young people being criticized today. They're called the me generation. I don't know if that's true. Perhaps they are a bit the now generation, anxious to have life's benefits immediately. And there may be a little truth in that, but I would contend that these youngsters today are under much more stress than we were. I mean, they were nurtured in a strange kind of a crucible that saw, three assassinations, a very unpopular war, a president resign in disgrace, growth of technology that's overwhelming to all of us, a lack of surety that the jobs for which they're preparing themselves will be needed in just a few years. And yet they're holding up very well. In fact, they're very sensitive. They're very caring, I find. They work very hard.
Are they smarter?
I don't think they're dumber.
Are they smarter than the generation or two generations before them?
I don't think they're any dumber, which people seem to want to suggest. I think that we were equally bright. I think that they're bright. It's just that the knowledge that they have to deal with is so expansive. Technological changes are occurring now in terms of years and even months. It used to take generations to occur.
In fact, didn't somebody just say that in the last 10 years we have advanced more technologically than all the rest of the time on this earth prior to that?
Well, sure. Would you imagine, J.P., when I used to listen to you back in the 50s, and we're getting older, that you would have a terminal sitting next to your microphone that would provide you the information that you now can receive in a hair's breadth?
I wouldn't have imagined that 10 years ago.
10 years ago you would not have, because we didn't have PCs until 10 years ago. And I can't even possibly conceive what will be needed or what we'll have in the year 2000. I'm not going to have to cope with it, but these youngsters will.
Because of the incredible advances in technology, the teaching techniques have changed. Audiovisual techniques have been here for some time, but now you brought up the terminal. The terminal is used as a teaching aid. That has changed the way you go about the education business dramatically, hasn't it?
Yes, because it allows us to disseminate information much more rapidly. The legislature just passed is part of the appropriations bill this time, a $2 million set aside to develop a technology network, which initially will involve the four research universities, Michigan, Michigan State, Michigan Tech, and Wayne, in a process of disseminating very quickly information to the industrial and business community through the use of the computer. And that's going to change the whole face of technology and economic development for the state of Michigan. Well, the fact of the matter is that we have to think about new ways of teaching our students because they're accustomed to this technology, be it video or be it computers. And for the dissemination of information, you really don't have to have a lecture. You know, you can do that with a terminal. You can do it with a textbook. You need a faculty
member. Or a videotape.
Yeah, you need a faculty member just to exchange ideas, to explore concepts, and to perhaps, I think, now promulgate some values.
Will grad school, do you think, for future generations, for this one and all the generations in the future, be the rule rather than the exception? Do you see the need, because of the technology explosion that we're going through, for all of us and the caretakers of the future generations to be more educated?
Well, it's clear that there has to be more education. I don't know if it'll be graduate study in every instance. Some people have to be retrained entirely, assume entirely new careers. You know, one of our big areas of emphasis now is lifelong learning. We're rethinking all of lifelong learning. We're in a renaissance. Initially, it was workshops, you know, continuing education, which we still do, refresher courses and ways of stimulating interest. Now we're returning to actually offering credit for those experiences and degrees and much more rigid programming, because we're finding that many people want to change careers, and some have to pursue careers now later in their lives when they didn't think they would have to at a younger age, homemakers, etc. So we have to think about that as part of a continuum. You know, education is not my university or universities. Education is everything from preschool, K through 12, higher education, and lifelong learning.
And it doesn't end at age 18 or 21 or 26.
Absolutely not. It's lifelong. But going back to your original question as well, one of our most critical needs is not necessarily graduate study, which we still need in order to produce the kinds of research capability that we need and the teachers, etc. But it's also technical training for those at the secondary school level and immediately thereafter. You know, I've talked to some of our corporate leadership here, and I remember having a particular conversation with Lee Iacocca, in which I said to him that you can't have a person on the assembly line today who cannot read a manual, who cannot run a computer terminal. And unless we do something to enhance the education in our elementary and secondary schools, we're going to create the greatest underclass the world's ever seen. And that is a more fundamental need, almost, than the kind of education that we even provide.
And yet, President DiBiagio, should everyone go to college?
No, I'm saying, but perhaps everybody should have some post-secondary education. You know, the Truman Commission in 1949 was the first to say that a substantial number of our people should have education beyond college, beyond high school. They said they projected 49% should go on beyond high school. The Eisenhower Commission in the 50s said 60%. But they didn't conceive of that meaning 4 years of college. They said training beyond the high school level.
In the crafts.
And some of it would have
mechanics.
Been technologic, sure.
But there should be no stigma attached to somebody who happens to work with his hands because he didn't have a college degree.
I hope not, because we need those people, but we need people who, along with that, have analytic capability, who can think clearly. Because if you can't read and view and listen intelligently today, if you can't analyze and synthesize and apply information, you cannot survive. It's just like we were talking about earlier, JP. Things have changed so dramatically in our lifetime. Things have changed so dramatically in the past decade, that if you weren't able to adjust to this technology, you couldn't continue in your role, no matter how talented you are, because you need to work with the technology. Well, the reason you're able to do that is you've got an analytic preparation in your college experience. That same preparation has to be provided to students in high school, and those who simply go to a community college or to a technical school, they still have to develop that ability to think clearly.
Good to see you. Thank you very much for
being
with us. See you up at the East Lansing on some of those warm Saturday afternoons, I hope.
Hope to see you more often now.
Oh, we will. We have Doug Weber on, your athletic director, too, in just a couple of weeks.
Great.
And, of course, we'll be talking to George Perlis on those Mondays. Thanks very much. The president of Michigan State, John A. DiBiagio.